to wait a sec.
Because it was working until Ali some means the first
time. Okay. Okay, just having some technical difficulties here, but should be ready in a minute, hopefully. Okay. So, should we get started? Not expecting anyone else, are we? Peter is not coming today. Probably know that already. But anyway, he heard that one before, so it's just us. So I know most of you, I guess. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Stephen Lemoine. I'm an associate professor here. I teach computer graphics. But when it comes to research, I'm interested in two things. One is hyperspectral image analysis, and this is what I'm talking about today. The other one is image quality, and that's what I will talk about tomorrow. Seemingly quite different topics, but with similar foundations, at least the way I see it. But today I want to focus on explaining what hyperspectral imaging is, just maybe a little recap for some of you, for most of you, maybe something new for some of you. And I want to explain a little bit some of the work I've done in the context of agriculture and post-harvest and food science, just a few examples, but I want to focus mostly on the analysis aspect of this research. So hyperspectral images have a lot of challenges associated to them when it comes to analyzing them. So I want to tell you a little bit about these challenges and how to overcome them. Sounds good? Yeah. So how many of you know what hyperspectral imaging is?
We had maybe three lectures in hyperspectral imaging.
Yeah. So all the cozy would know. But I will, you know, for the sake of completion, and for those of you who don't know what hyperspectral imaging is, just a little recap. At least if you know already, you've never seen it presented like this. So, you know, just another perspective. So, we have a nice farm, that's context here, and a certain light source, the sun in that case, which has a spectral power distribution, so specific characteristics of that light source. And we have crops, for example, plants. It can be a forest, can be different types of farms. We will talk about it. And if it's a crop, it has a certain reflectance. That reflectance is an intrinsic characteristic of the crop. So if you change the daylight, or if you wait a little bit for later in the day, or if you have some clouds, or if you move to a different place on Earth for some reason, the radiance, the spectrum of the light will change, the perceived color will change, what an RGB camera would perceive would change, but the reflectance, the object, wouldn't, right? So that's one of the problems, one of the most fundamental problems in color imaging, is to discard the effect of the illuminance and retrieve the actual properties of the object. So, property in that case being the reflectance. There are other properties we could look at, but hyperspectral imaging is about recovering the reflectance. with a fairly high resolution. So where color imaging takes three broadband, red, green, blue, these are not actual sensitivities, of course, but just an illustration, and combines all these bands, all these three bands, into a color image to reproduce it on a display, on a projector, printer. In a printer, it doesn't work in RGB, but has some kind of conversion, and it remains relatively low dimensional, three dimensions in printer, CMY plus the black. But relatively small number of variables to represent color. And the sensitivity of these typical RGB cameras, red, green, blue cameras, the ones that you all have in your pockets, your webcam, your DSLR camera you have, it's limited to the visible range, which is 400, 700, or 380, maybe 780 if you want to be a little bit broader. But limited to visible range. So it means that we capture the interaction between the light, the object, and the camera, but without being able really to recover any of those three elements separately. So we can capture the influence of the three. We can, if we have the camera, we can probably infer the sensitivity of the camera. So that leaves us with the reflectance and the illuminant as two quantities that are merged in that RGB data. So we cannot recover either. We just have the combination of the two at a fairly low resolution, spectral resolution. Hyperspectral imaging or multispectral imaging, or generally spectral imaging, just talk about the differences in a moment. More channels, more narrow band sensitivities for each of the channels, and a wider range, possibly in the ultraviolet, although that's relatively rare, but most importantly in the near infrared and sometimes even in shortwave infrared, where a lot of information about crops, for example, crop health, can be found, water content or whatever. And that gives you a spectral image. So multi or hyper, it's basically how many channels. Depends who you talk to as well. I mean, I'm going to use both terms without distinctions. It means the same thing. An image that contains more than three channels. And from this kind of images, you can typically recover the reflectance. You can separate reflectance from radiance. So the reflectance of the object from the influence of the illuminant. In a very abstract way of saying it, would be the color of the illuminant and the color of the objects. It's not appropriate to talk about color here, but just to give you an idea, you can think of these two things as two different colors. And of course, the more channels you have in your hyperspectral data, the higher the resolution, and the more tiny details you can perceive. Applications, obviously, we're going to talk about farming, precision farming, it's a fancy term, fruit grading, or meat fish inspection. So I'm not going to go into the detail of how that works, but I'm just going to give you some examples, some case studies very briefly. But other applications, of course, medical imaging, environment. We have a very big initiative at the moment on the Lake Mjøsa, where we are trying to combine different types of imaging technologies, including satellite imaging. We have, NTNU has a satellite actually in orbit, which we have access to. It has a hyperspectral sensor on it, and we can use that to combine it with some drone data to have a better spatial resolution, because typically satellite image where you have like 10 by 10 meters per pixel. Well, that's not uncommon to have even less than that. So the NTNU satellite has actually 100 by 100 meter on the ground. So that's not really, really high. So typically satellite hyperspectral imaging needs to be combined with some drone or plane imagery. Anyway, so that's for environmental science. We're trying to detect algal bloom on Mjøsa, for example, which can be harmful for biodiversity and so on. Forestry, so I work with people who are interested in finding out in New Zealand there's a big culture of preserving their local flora. The trees, they have unique trees, they have unique wildlife over there, and they are very scared of people bringing in bacteria or diseases that will harm their trees. Some of them are very weak, at least they can be very easily damaged by some kind of bacteria. So in forestry, if you use remote sensing, you can detect if a tree has been infected and cut it down as quickly as possible to avoid that the disease spreads. And hyperspectral imaging can allow you to detect these diseases quite early, at least some kind of diseases. In civil engineering, any idea of what kind of applications we could use hyperspectral imaging for in civil engineering?
Detection of maybe holes in the ground?
Yes, holes and cracks, yes. Very good. Hyperspectral imaging has a very important part of it is that you actually capture near-infrared data as well. So pretty much anything that can be seen in the infrared would be it would be useful to use hyperspectral imaging for. For example, cracks, construction, like defaults that you don't necessarily see to the naked eye. I currently work on a project where it's a little bit tangential to civil engineering, but it's a main application. We want to help New Zealand local population, the Maori people, the Polynesian people, to preserve their cultural heritage by flying drones with a number of imaging modalities, including hyperspectral, to detect burial grounds, some of which are secret and unknown to the local people. And it has happened in the past that in order to build a road, they would just build a road without taking care of checking whether there was something under. And they found, in some cases, they found that they had built a road on top of a very important burial site, at least important for the local tribes. So we're trying to use imaging to help civil engineering develop in a sustainable way, in a culturally sensitive way, for example. So that's just one example also. Astronomy, obviously, either from the Earth or on a probe, you will typically have sensors that do not have only RGB. So in many probes, you have an RGB sensor, but you also have a spectral one. And they typically have a fairly poor spatial resolution, but they allow you to get information about what, for example. If you have sent a probe in space and you put a hyperspectral sensor on it, why would you do that?
I think for water detection.
For water detection, yeah, to analyze the atmosphere, to see any signs of life. Yeah. And waste sorting as well, that's another application, I think. See if you have nothing. Maybe you've seen that before, you heard that before?
Yeah. There was this article, I think like 6 years ago, I came across, it was using, it was multi-spectral imaging, it wasn't hyper, but like it was using it to categorize different polymer base.
So obviously a very important application, yeah. And 6 years ago, you said, so today you can imagine that. They are, I'm not very familiar with that, but there are probably some places where they are using that already to sort waste. Worth looking into, though. I mean, I have no idea what the status of this, but I think it's really, really useful in that context as well. And any other applications that I didn't mention here for hyperspectral imaging? I guess, well.
Also in art? Like
yes, cultural heritage, of course, obviously a very big thing here at the Color Lab, analyzing pigments. For example, I remember visiting the National Gallery a few years ago, and they were showing us a painting where there was a character with a hat, And it turned out through hyperspectral image, through hyperspectral analysis, they were able to find out that the pigment that were used to paint the hat was only invented 100, 200 years after the painting was actually painted. So they found out that it was added on top, and there was another kind of hat under. But that's just one example. So yes, cultural heritage, obviously a very, very big application of that sort of technology. Anything else? You can put a lot of things under the environment umbrella. You know, forestry actually is one of them, but glaciology, ocean observation, ocean monitoring, you name it. So, obviously, a very big technology. And when it comes to farming, or at least hyperspectral imaging has been historically used mostly for remote sensing. Over the past 10, 20 years, maybe, it's been used more and more in close-range context. So if I have a fruit here and I want to inspect the quality of the fruit, that's close-range. Remote sensing, the sensor is in space or on plane or on a drone. But even drones have been popular for what, like 10, 15 years now? So the first research around hyperspectral image analysis or hyperspectral imaging was typically using satellite data for remote sensing. And so today I want to focus a little bit on precision farming, but of course I mentioned ocean monitoring, forestry, geology. I have a colleague who actually is trying to get funded a big project in New Zealand to be able to automatically find where there is minerals, copper, gold, you name it. And you can do that with hyperspectral imaging, theoretically. So, lots of different applications. And just another illustration of the technology here. It's fine, pretty nice. You have your satellite in space, you have a certain region on the ground, and for each pixel in the image that will be captured, you have a full, you have a spectrum, right? Spectrum of wavelength from 400 to typically 2000. Even more nanometers. And from this spectrum, you can differentiate between vegetation, water, soil, etc. Okay? So we typically talk about a hyperspectral cube because you have two spatial dimensions and one spectral, which is quite significant. Okay? But close range sensing, so these are examples of close range. These are not my pictures. In fact, these are not even my, related to my research, but I have worked on a project where people are using a very similar kind of platform here. And these are just illustrations anyway, just to show you that you can be on the farm, put a hyperspectral sensor at the back of your tractor, or at the front in that case, and it will then control how much nutrient the back of your tractor will actually spread based on how much the plant needs. Right, so it's pretty cool stuff. And here for indoor farming, or vertical farming as well, they would be using hyperspectral sensors for monitoring, again, health and diseases and making sure everything grows smoothly. And like I said, it was initially a field, a domain, a research field where people would be focusing on remote sensing data. So typically from mid-1990s to the mid-2000, I guess, mostly satellite airplane data. UAVs have been, of course, coming up a lot since early 2010s here. This is the third bar here, that's UAVs. So that's number of publications that use different hyperspectral imaging platforms over time. Right. So that indicates the popularity of the technology. And now we also see a pretty big increase of close range sensing. Right. So starting very low here, and now it's almost... It is actually, it dominates the the research field, papers using research projects using hydropical imagers in a close range context. Yep. Any questions about this? So, multi-spectral, hyperspectral, spectral, what's the difference? It's just semantics. It depends who you talk to. Not always consistent in the literature. Depends on the field. Don't let it confuse you. It's really irrelevant. But if you want to give a definition, so typically, multi refers to a few bands, so from four. You can have RGB plus infrared and call it multispectral. To a few dozens, so typically no more than about 80 or even 100. But 100 would already start being hyperspectral, I suppose. Again, a little subjective here. And multi refers typically also to the only the visible range of wavelength. If you have the infrared, well, I know I just said RGB plus infrared is multispectral. But it would be called multispectral because it has only a few bands. But, yeah. So hyper, more bands, broader range, sometimes up to 3,000 nanometers in the shortwave infrared. It's weird. Means shortwave infrared. Near means? Near infrared. Yep. Okay, so multi, hyper, or just spectral. So, for precision agriculture, I mentioned this example of a hyperspectral sensor on tractor. Here's another one. So the idea is, of course, to better understand the needs of the crop. How much fertilizer, but also how much water. Right? Water is starting to become scarce, or has become scarce for a few decades now. So it's, of course, very important to give the optimal amount of water to the plant. No more, no less, to be more efficient. And, of course, the idea is also to reduce the environmental risk and footprint. Mursa, and like many lakes and rivers around the world, are polluted by nitrogen, are polluted by different types of things that come out of farms. Not only crops, farms, only also animal farms, obviously. But, so that's, of course, it's a big pollution problem. I don't think I need to motivate this. So if you can reduce the amount of nutrient, or if you find the exact amount of nutrient you need to give to your plant, you're not overdoing it, and you limit the risk of pollution. And the idea is, of course, apart from saving the planet and all that stuff, provide information to farmers to build up a record of their farm to be more efficient over time, especially for small farms. I've been involved in a few projects in New Zealand where we were working with small farmers, and they are struggling and they need a little bit more efficiency in what they are doing, so it's important to help them do that, to improve, help them make better decisions, allow better traceability, so that's from the farmer to the from farm to fork, as they say. It's very important for the consumer when they buy something to know where it comes from and ensure that it hasn't been tampered with. And I will show you an example of how hyperspectral imaging can be used to, for example, find if a beef steak is 100% beef or if it's been altered with other kind of meats, which happens more often than you think. Maybe not in Norway, but in other countries it does. And we have seen examples of that, and hyperspectral imaging can help. Of course, enhanced marketing and farm products, again, probably more useful for the small farmers. Improve lease arrangements, optimize the use of their real estate, and enhance the inherited quality of farm products for everybody's sake. So, of course, there's not just hyperspectral imaging to help with that, but it does contribute to these. So, so here's an example. So these are examples of projects that have been carried out in New Zealand. I've contributed to a few of them. And on top here, you have a map of a farm. You know, you are a farmer, and you wonder, okay, how much water should I give to which part of my farm? How should I tune my irrigation system? How should I tune my nutrient, my fertilizing system? But I have a pretty big farm, so what do I do? Well, call Massey University, which is the place where I used to work, and have them fly their hyperspectral sensor over the farm, and they will create maps for you. And this is an example of a map where you can see, okay, I probably need a little bit more nutrient in that region. It's a bit more deficient. Whereas some regions, we really just don't need to go there because they are looking good, all right? So, you know, farming 2.0, if you want. And then in the future, you can think of using drones to go exactly where you want to deliver the nutrients, and fertilizer, and so on. So, hyperspectral imaging can help estimating biochemical and biophysical properties, again, for quality, diseases, and so on. Environment, evaluating crop nutrient status, classifying imagery to identify different crop types, growing stages, weeds, stress, and so on. Retrieving soil moisture. Obviously, if you are in a region where it rains a lot, which New Zealand is, at least where I used to live, it rains a lot, a lot. So it was important to know after a heavy rain, okay, which part of the farm still need to be watered, if any. And predicting yield using clever data-driven models, machine learning, and the right kind of imagery or the right kind of sensing, you can, to an extent, predict how much yield you will get, how much how many apples you will get in your farm overall. And you can even do that to an extent from a seed. I'll tell you a little bit more about this in a moment. And if you have animals, well, you can monitor their health. We have people working at the Color Lab on monitoring pig on a farm, and they use computer vision for this. And they use behavioral analysis, so to check how the pig would behave and if they are likely to be stressed based on how they move, for example. And there are many other projects around the world to monitor animal pain, for example, just through imaging. Hyperspectral imaging is helpful in that case, not necessarily to have a better estimate of the behavior, but really to have a better way to remove the effect of illuminant in the scene, which is always a problem when you try to identify where's my pig, and you have like a very a scene with a lot of specularities, a lot of shadows, a lot of background noise, basically. So the higher the spectral resolution, the better the precision with which you can identify animals. Any questions about this? Here's another type of farm. This is for aquaculture. This was Benoit, one of my colleagues back in Massey University in New Zealand. And he, on the side, he had this farm where he grew spirulina. How do you pronounce this?
Spirulina.
So you all know what that is? A superfood. It's like an algae. You put it in your smoothie, and it's disgusting. But it's full of it smells bad. It looks funny. It looks nice. I think it has this very nice. This doesn't look like a nice picture, but it's like bluish in some cases. So it's pretty nice appearance. But it tastes. It's really horrible. But it's really good for you. Lots of protein and lots of nutrients. Whatever. I don't know. So, but they wanted to determine how they could market their product. So this was mostly, if the color if the algae has a certain color, then it can be marketed as the blue one or the green one. You know, I've worked also with a kiwi fruits producer. I'll talk about it in a moment, where they produce red kiwi fruit and they sell it as red. If you open it and it just looks a little bit pinkish, you're probably not going to be happy. So here's the same sort of thing. They want to figure out how blue is the algae, how green is it, actually how blue is it going to look once it's been extracted and dried. And they want to do it from inside the farm, which looks like this, really, in the water. Big problem capturing images in the water. So we did a little project where we analyzed the transmittance of water containing algae. And we used, you know, basically a light source like this and a hyperspectral sensor on top. And we were able to determine from this that we can predict very accurately the amount of phycocyanin, so the blue pigments, and the amount of chlorophyll, green pigment. What is the red pigment called? Anyone knows?
Rhodopsin.
Something
starts with rod. Rod? Okay. I must, or maybe ask something.
Okay, there might be more. There might be more. There's the one that ends with cyanin. And anthocyanin? Anthocyanin, yeah. I guess it comes from anti and cyan, so it's anti-cyan, so red. But there are definitely others, I'm sure. So maybe, Tia, you would give us the name of other red pigments, if you find them. Well, it will be relevant in the capital flight, so I can come back to that. But yeah, hyperspectral images. RGB, we proved that RGB images were not sufficient to do that. So that was a big research question we had. Is it worth using hyperspectral sensors? Because they are expensive and they produce massive amount of data, which is expensive to store, to process, and so on. So this worked out pretty well. The question is then, how do we put this in the farm? We didn't go to that point. Maybe they did since then. I haven't followed up on that project. That's an example. This is a project I haven't worked on, but I visited a salmon farm, up north in a town called Rørvik, which is a couple of hours north of Trondheim. And this is one of many they have in Norway, obviously. And they used hyperspectral imaging in two places, one in the farm, in the actual water with live animals, to detect lice, kind of a little animal that can affect the health of the salmon. It's a big problem, apparently. They use a hyperspectral imager for that they put underwater. It looks like this. This is a real one. It's actually produced by a Norwegian company called Ecotone. And it has its own light source. As you can see, it's illuminating in a particular wavelength or in a particular range of wavelengths, probably more reddish hues, because I assume this is where you have the highest contrast between healthy and non-healthy fish, or where you can see the lice more, contrast between the lice and the skin. And so they put this underwater and they can determine which fish are problematic. Now, don't ask me how they separate the fish afterwards, but they, you know, at least they get the data and then they do what they have to do to separate the unhealthy fish. But the other place where they would use the hyperspectral sensor is because it's a whole farm, so they produce and then they fillet the salmon. They create this nice little sashimi fillet you can buy at Rematusen. So I'll just come back to this previous slide in a moment. But this is another place where they use the hyperspectral camera, and there's a company which you might have heard of, NEO, Norsk Elektrooptik. They produce this really expensive hyperspectral camera we have down in the lab, the high specs camera. And they are very active in, spreading the good word of hyperspectral imaging in the whole of Norway and beyond. But especially in the fish industry, this is where, of course, Norway is very active as well. And they placed a few of their sensors in the production line, conveyor belts, where they can detect not only if the fish is sick, or maybe there are some residual of sickness after farm, they can detect blood clots that will affect the quality, the visual appearance of the fillet. When you buy a fish fillet that has some blood in it, doesn't look really good. If you buy a cheap one, it's still good, right? But it doesn't look good. So, but they want to be able to market different fillet to different people, higher price if you have really nice visual appearance, of course. And this can be, to an extent, predicted from that stage, actually. And you can, of course, predict as well more like the fat, the moisture content, which will affect the texture, the taste, and so on. So another place where you can use hyperspectral imaging on a salmon farm. So, but that's after the farm, so to speak. That's post-harvest, even though in that case it's not really harvesting, but after the farm. So just going back on this slide. So this is a project I worked on with a company called Biolumic. And they were basically what they do is that they apply UV treatment to seeds to boost the yield. Just from the seed, they can apply a specific light treatment, and it will make that plant few months or few even years down the line will produce more. It's pretty amazing if you ask me, but they were interested in knowing if the treatment was effective like just after the treatment. Of course they can wait a few months and see, oh yeah, it worked, we have more apples or more whatever, soy in that in the case of the project. But they wanted to see, okay, we just treated the seeds, did it work? Because it doesn't always work. And they wanted to see if we could do that with hyperspectral imaging. It was a very confidential product. Signed a lot of NDAs. I never signed as many NDAs as with this project. So I can only tell you a little bit about it, but suffice it to say that it did work to an extent. We had to resort to some pretty heavy deep learning models to process a lot of data and to find that they were really, really some tiny spectral features. And when I mean spectral features, I mean like really tiny, narrow range of wavelength where there were some peaks in some seeds and not peaks in the others. So we needed this really high spectral resolution just to find out that there is this two or three wavelengths where we can segregate between treatment that worked, seeds where the treatment worked, and seeds where the treatment didn't work. So that's actually something you do very often with hyperspectral imaging. You use it just to find out, actually use this whole range of wavelengths just to find out you only need a little bit. But you need to analyze the whole range to find out this at the end. So you can use hyperspectral sensor to then design a sensor that would be really tailored to your application. That's a really common application, a really common way to use hyperspectral imaging. Right, so pretty cool stuff. Some of my colleagues from the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand, they developed this robot. In fact, there's also one at the University of Auckland, I think, and Massey University is developing their own. They're not quite there yet to pick the kiwi fruit. They also have robots to pick pick apples and blueberries to an extent. I'm not sure what the status of that. Last time I checked, they were trying not to squish the blueberry. So they had this sort of really soft robotic techniques to pick the blueberries, identify. And they involved me because they wanted to know if we can predict the ripeness based on the spectral imaging. So anyway, so that's actually this robot. You see it in real. It's pretty impressive. It picks the fruit like this. That's the future. Scary to an extent, but exciting. As a researcher, I have to say, pretty exciting. And that works. It picks the fruit, it detects which ones are ripe, and then it sorts them based on size.
Like, for this project, hyperspectral imaging is used to determine which kiwi is good to pick.
Yes. Yes, but it turns out the main advantage of hyperspectral imaging in that case is, like before, discard the illuminant, discard the influence of the illuminant, whether it's discarding the reflectance or the shadow highlights and so on.
Yeah,
but yes, of course. With that, with hyperspectral, you can find out how much sugar is in the fruit, is it ripe, or do we need to pick it up later? All right. just showed you this one. Some meat example from meat industry. I did a small project on this as well. You can detect how much fat is the meat. You can estimate the amount of protein, and you can find out whether you have foreign material. So, for example, one big problem they had in at the Meat Industry Association, yes, in New Zealand, is waste. They waste a lot. So when there's a carcass that comes, it's a bit disgusting, but it's, you know, it's a real application of hyperspectral imaging. So close your eyes, close your ears if you're vegan and you know, offended by these sort of things. But you know, they bring in a carcass, and then the carcass, first thing they do is they remove the skin of it. And there's a robot that does it, and it's really brutal. And the carcass then shakes a lot. And what happens very often is that there was some fecal matter on the carcass that spreads and ends up on the actual meat. And this, of course, is a contaminant and is to be removed. And typically what they do is that they inspect this with the eye, so subjectively, and say, okay, there's a little bit of fecal matter there. Let's cut around. And that's usually they cut really a lot around it. And this is where you have a lot of waste. If you use hyperspectral imaging, so the project we were supposed to develop, it turned out it was a little bit more complicated than we thought, but the idea was take a tablet with a hyperspectral sensor on it and use augmented reality to find out where exactly you have contaminants, be it fecal matter or anything else, and then, you know, have an estimate of what's the minimum you need to cut to really preserve the rest of the meat, and that saves waste, for example. So turns out it was a good idea, but in practice it was a little bit more complicated. Anyway, I'm sure in a few years' time we will see something like this. And then a project that I was not involved in, but I was asked to grade a PhD thesis on using deep learning hyperspectral imaging to find out whether a meat is actually pure beef as labeled, or if it contains other types of meat. And it turns out it works pretty well. So you can use hyperspectral imaging to determine the composition of your meat, basically, quality. I've also seen people work on honey. In New Zealand, they have this Manuka honey, which maybe you heard about this, Manuka. Okay, so yeah, it's made its way all here. Manuka is the kind of tree I was talking about earlier, by the way, the ones that are sensitive and that they want to preserve. So it's very, really very big market around this, as you can imagine. So, and I had some colleagues who were looking at estimating the Manuka-ness, the content of Manuka in honey, with hyperspectral imaging. And it turns out it works to an extent. And they can then market the product based on more robust objective analysis techniques. This is a project that I worked on with a student, and we were trying to find out whether we could use a smartphone with an RGB camera, but taking pictures at different angles, and do the same as hyperspectral imaging, using not the reflectance, but the BRDF. For those of you who are doing the computer graphics, you know by now what BRDF is. So different materials will have different properties, will have different appearance from different angles, right? And if you can map this BRDF bidirectional reflectance distribution function to a certain property of the material, like for example, if there's some iridescence, typically the meat is started, either it was cut improperly, or it starts to go bad in some cases. So if you have a certain type of iridescence, you can capture that with RGB. You don't need hyperspectral. And you can infer the same sort of characteristics or measurements with just RGB but different angles. So this worked pretty nicely. It was a real problem to capture the steak, though, especially because when you do any kind of imaging, typically multispectral, but even in that case RGB, you want a broad spectrum light, right? So halogen typically. If you use LED, it will be spiky, so your hyperspectral camera will capture nothing in potentially key wavelengths where there's no light emitted. So halogen has a broader, much smoother, broader spectrum, so it's useful, but it's warm. So after 10 minutes, the steak will shrunk, cooked, basically. So this was in a cold room, but still. So imaging of meat is challenging, but well, it was an interesting project. So let's take a break.
Once.
Yeah. 5 minutes break. And if you have any questions, of course, let me know. Did you see the hyperspectral sensor we have? The high specs, the big one? No? The access to the room is restricted. In fact, I don't even have access to it. But I'm sure in the future you will be given a tour of this. It's a black room, black walls. You have like this conveyor belt with a hyperspectral sensor like this. It looks exactly like that.
Oh, yeah.
You have two of them, a blue one and a red one. You saw that?
Yeah, I think.
And in the back you have like a... Yep. So that's, what, €500,000 or something? Oh. And a lot of problems, restrictions when it comes to accessing it, especially for people from certain countries. That's a big, big issue we have at the moment. You've heard about export control.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that's where we're at. Anyway, break. Thank you. just wait for Nicola. So, there we go. Ta-da. After the farm, I mentioned blueberry picking. You pick which ones are ripe, but by the time they end up on the conveyor belt, they might have lost some of their qualities. They must have been squeezed, shaken, deteriorated in some ways, and it's actually used, high-spectral imaging is used on a conveyor belt, like I said, for salmon, fish, also for fruit. We did try at some point to detect the quality of garlic from outside. Turns out impossible, even with high-spectral imaging. There's too much skin. So, in that case, what sort of other approach would you think of if you can't see through? Like a kiwi fruit, for example. You can tell a lot of the quality of the fruit looking at something called the outer pericarp. So it's just basically, you cut the fruit in half, you have the central pericarp, and then you have the outer pericarp. So pretty much just under the skin, you have a lot of information about the quality of the fruit. But the skin is thick. So even with hyperspectral, even with near-infrared spectroscopy, you can't really penetrate the skin of a kiwi fruit, or garlic for that matter. So what would we do in that case? If you were given the task like this, what sort of sensing technique would you use to penetrate the skin? Any idea?
X-rays,
yeah, sure, it will cook your kiwi fruit. Yeah, no, probably. I'm not sure about the viability of this, it must be expensive.
I mean, some other way.
I don't know, actually. I don't think so, but maybe. But what's been done, and what works well, is to actually not necessarily change your sensor, but change your illuminant. Use a laser. Laser will penetrate and measure how laser light is scattered. So you just use subsurface scattering. Now, those of you who are doing the computer graphics course, we'll talk about subsurface scattering. We did talk a little bit about this, that how it models how light penetrates an object at a certain location and exits at a different location. And because of this, it gives a certain appearance effect. But it also tells you something about the material itself. If the light is emitted, that's emitted is reflected straight at the same from the same place as it arrived, there is no subsurface scattering. But if there is subsurface scattering, you can sort of measure to what extent, in what wavelength, etc., characterize the subsurface scattering, but you need a laser for this. Or you need you need a pretty thin skin, where you don't need you don't need laser, or use laser, pretty much. And hyperspectral imaging to then analyze the dependency of the subsurface scattering on the wavelength. All right, so talking about kiwi fruit, that's a project I'm still working on, actually. We are trying to get a bit more money now from Zespri, the kiwi fruit. You probably ate these guys' kiwi fruits, right? So, kiwi fruit, all right? And they produce a bunch of kiwi fruit, and now they are focusing most of their research effort on this red variety, because the green ones they've tried to improve the quality, the efficiency for many years, but at this point today, all their technology, all their genetic research on how to develop the right fruit has been copied, to not say stolen. But well, there are other markets. I don't want to name any specific countries, but there's one particularly very, very big country which also produces a lot of kiwi fruit, and they tend to reproduce research from other countries in this context. So that's coming from the Esprit themselves. So they don't really focus much of their research money on green or even yellow, golden kiwi fruits. Maybe it's not so popular here yet, but it's starting to see it. It's probably a bit more expensive. Sweeter, really delicious, the golden one. But the next step is the red one. So they are really interested in developing a workflow to estimate the quality, because they want to make sure that if they send a product to a customer, and I mean like a supermarket chain, for example, so they send a bunch of like a million kiwi fruits to Rema Thyssen for distribution in Norway. If the representative of Rema Thyssen receives, you know, the cases of fruits, takes one, opens it, and say like, that's not what I ordered, it's not red, then there's a problem. So that's actually the basis of their of this project. That's how it came to be. They wanted to have a way to say, to grade the kiwi fruit. It has a redness of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that needs to be done from two perspectives. First, the imaging part. We need to be able to capture the, you know, take an image, take a picture, preferably with a smartphone, something easy that you don't need to also ship with the fruit. And so people can take a picture, and the picture will automatically recognize how many red pixels or whatever, and then connect that to a perceptual model. So two aspects, capturing and then mapping to a perceptual model. And the perceptual model was basically, we did ask a lot of people to look at pictures of fruit and the different illuminance and rate the redness from 1 to 5, I think we did. So we use hyperspectral imaging to capture the fruit, render them under different illuminance, obtain the subjective scores, and then map, link those subjective scores to the hyperspectral data. And what we found out is basically there's one wavelength, one out of, we were using 440 or something. One wavelength was sufficient in the visible range. One wavelength was sufficient to predict the redness. But we didn't know that. And in fact, it's maybe doesn't sound very reasonable to you right now, but it did sound reasonable to us at the time that there would be some more than just one wavelength. Right? The problem would be probably more complicated than just taking a red wavelength image and that's it. It seemed like it had to do with also the amount of greenness. If there's more green, even if there's a lot of red, well, the green sort of may overcome it. So it turns out there was an effect of the greenness. But what we did is just calculated the ratio of red pixels over non-red pixels, pretty much, basically. And we were able to predict consumer scores. But there's much more to it, and we are doing that at the moment. But hyperspectral imaging was the basis of this work. And one confusion I've encountered a lot in some places, some industry, some students, is that there are really, well, there are two types of applications when it comes to food. One is trying to understand the color, the appearance, the perception of the quality of the fruit. In which case, it's you have to ask people, you have to get some subjective data. And it's the applications of this was really typically marketing. Making sure that when someone buys a product, it looks the way they expect it to look. And then there's another aspect of food, of application of hyperspectral imaging in the food industry, is measuring the properties of the object itself. Not how it looks, not how it appears, but how it actually is. And these two things tend to be different. You can't judge the amount of sugar that's in a fruit just by looking at it. Right? So this is the second aspect. Physics-centered, estimating reflectance, scattering, texture, in order to infer sugar content, moisture content, whatever. Also forecasting, like how much yield you will have. For example, I showed you this example of the seeds, where we were trying to predict how much yield they would produce. So it's really important to distinguish color, which has to do with how we perceive, how we feel, how looks, how good it looks. That's more like marketing kind of domain. And reflectance, which induces color, but is focusing on the product rather than focusing on the consumer. That makes sense? Really important, really surprising how often these two things are mixed together. In fact, Zespri, this company, they were using C-Lab color space in order to infer the amount of sugar in the fruit. I mean, it's possible that it works, but it's something a little bit ill-advised in using a model that was specifically designed for perception, for another application than perception, right? You know what I mean? So it may work, but it probably works better without C-Lab, with another kind of color space. Anyway. Some challenges of hyperspectral imaging. So I want to focus mostly on the remote sensing aspect here. So I'm not going to go too much into the detail here. I mean, I could, but we really don't have much time. And I want to try and give you an overview of why there's advantages. There's a lot of things you can do with hyperspectral imaging. I just showed you that. But it's also very difficult to process that data. In short, it gives you a lot of data. It gives you a lot of dimensions. Each pixel has up to 400 dimensions. And so if you want to do a clustering, if you want to do a classification, you're working in a 400-dimensional space. It's already pretty difficult to work in a three-dimensional space. At least you can visualize a three-dimensional space. 400 dimensions, good luck with visualizing that, and good luck with finding anything in such a space. And I will explain to you a little bit why. So this part is more technical, but I will try to not be too technical. So tell me if I'm going too much into the detail, if you don't understand something. And given that I prepared like way too many slides, I will probably have to cut short at some point, but I will try to make it in a natural way, hopefully. So three major problems, well, two major problems. Cost of sensor and acquisition. I'm not going to talk about the cost of flying a plane, it's really a bit irrelevant, but it is a problem. The cost of sending a sensor to space, over the years you have a pretty good return on investment, but if you just have to fly over the farm every time you want to create a map like the one I showed you before, it has certain costs, and that's not for everyone. It's not for very small farmers, for example. And the cost of sensor, of course, it goes without saying, hyperspectral is expensive. I mentioned this hyperspectral camera we have at the lab, the high-specs one. As far as I remember, it was about €500,000 euros. So that's a significant amount of money. Of course, you can do with less than that, and I will show you. You can have very small hyperspectral, multispectral, more like cameras for a few thousand euros, but they have limitations, of course. So you cannot do as much as what you can with a hyperspectral camera, such as the one we have in the lab. And importantly, the cost of mining that amount of data. That's actually what most of my research has focused on over the past few years, since my PhD. I did my PhD on that, on trying to visualize hyperspectral images, visualize all the amount of information there is in that. So you have 400 channels, a lot of information, and you need to compress that to three channels that convey all the color, the contrast, everything you need to see. So, and that is a really, really big challenge. So, cost of sensor. Just a word on different types of imaging technologies. The most simple is not really hyperspectral imaging. It's just like a spectrophotometer, a single pixel measurement, and you just move it around your scene. It's possible. Or you have, perhaps more commonly, the line scanner. That's the one we have in the lab. That's the one many cameras in orbit are based on. The antenna satellite is based on light scanning like this. So you have a full spectrum on one line, but then you need to move the line. So pretty much you have your camera here, and you have a conveyor belt that moves, and it captures a line at a time. You have your wavelength scan. We also have one or two of these devices in the lab, I think, where you have a typical monochromatic camera with a broad sensitivity, and then you just let you use a filter wheel or a liquid crystal tunable filter. So basically, you have a filter in front of your camera, and you adjust the filter so that it lets through only a certain wavelength you capture every time. So of course, this is, you can't capture a moving object with that, but it has, it's cheap. It's relatively cheap to do and to operate. Or you can have a snapshot camera. That's the best, of course, just one snapshot. It's like a normal camera, but you have more than RGB. You just take a picture and you have all your channels. But that is expensive because, as you can probably see from this diagram, you would need many much larger CCD sensor or CMOS, right? Because you will, for each pixel, you need the full spectrum. In an RGB camera, you would use what's called this mosaic. What's it called? Bayer filter. Yes, exactly. That's what I wanted to hear. So you have your Bayer filter. It's basically that in each pixel you will have only one wavelength, but because there's so much correlation between spatial between pixels, you can interpolate. And you have typically more green than red and blue, because green is at the right, at the center of the visible range of wavelength. So it's more luminance information there. But imagine if instead of having 1, 2, 3, you had like 10 or 20 or 400 different colors, different filters. Then you would need to interpolate a lot, or you would need a really large sensor. Of course, so that is expensive. But that's an example of a spectral filter array that was developed by some people in the lab, where you can have a sort of an extended version of a Bayer filter array for, I don't know how many colors they have, how many channels, 7 plus near, so 8 channels. And that is state-of-the-art in terms of snapshot. So you can imagine how much it would cost to have more than 7 channels in a snapshot. But just to give you an idea of costs, what can you get for less than 5,000 euros, 50,000 krona? This is a little camera. That's a picture that I've taken. That's a drone we used in New Zealand to make some estimation of chlorophyll content on farms. And that's a little camera. It's half the size of my smartphone here. Right, so it's really small. Of course, it needs a battery, it needs a little processor to be able to operate the data stream in real time if you want to, or to store it. But it's really lightweight, it's I'm not going to say very cheap, but it's cheaper, much, much cheaper than a full-blown hyperspectral camera with 400 channels. So you have only 9 bands. Actually, you have 8 bands plus like a broad band here. And with that, you can do quite a lot of things. They have several models, and of course, this is an older version. They have newer versions now. But I think what differs the most between their models is the range of wavelengths. You have one that's 400, 700, then you have one that's infrared, and then another one that's sort of in the middle. And that's one company called Cilios, a French company, but there are many others that produce these sensors of this size and multi-spectral. It's not really hyper, right? It's hard to put hyper in such a small device, but that's what you get for less than 50,000 krona. What you can get for more than 1 million krona, though, is a high-spec camera, for example. This one was developed by Norsk Elektrooptik, NEO, Norwegian company, and that's the one I was telling you earlier. That's the one we have in the lab. And we have two, actually. We have one for the visible plus near-infrared and one for the near-infrared plus shortwave infrared. So a blue one and this red one. And this one is 960 to 2,500 nanometers, pretty broad range, 360 bands, and 640 pixels line scan. So 640, the breadth of your image. The height is basically up to you. You scan. Okay. You can also do some. I'm not going to go into details here. You can take an RGB image and create a multi-pixel image. Not hyper, but multi. I mean, you're limited in how many channels you can interpolate between RGB bands. It's pretty much the same as equivalent of, you know, maybe I mentioned that example to you, but when you watch a TV series and they have like this really blurry image of a license plate and then suddenly you press a button, and you can see the very sharp number. It's the same idea here. You have only three channels, you can't see much, but you can interpolate, you can do so-called spectral super resolution. Sorry, that was actually the slide I wanted to tell you. Spectral super resolution. You can also merge an RGB and a high-spec spectral, or a high-spectral and a panchromatic, just a grayscale image. So high resolution, grayscale, high spatial resolution, grayscale. Low spatial resolution, high spectral resolution, multispectral. Combine the two, you can actually do a lot of really interesting stuff. This is used a lot in remote sensing. Spectral resolution, that's what I was telling you about. You have your RGB, and you use a prior on the distribution of RGB values in real life and distribution of reflectance values. And actually, I'm working currently on a project with a PhD student back in New Zealand where he's trying to find out what, if you use a deep neural network on this to do this, which is typical, you have an input image, RGB, big neural network, big black box, hyperspectral as an output. How does it work? If you ask the people who designed it, they will tell you, well, there's a layer that does this and a layer that does that. That many filters and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that doesn't really tell me what it uses in the image to infer the spectrum. So we are looking at what kind of spatial information. If a pixel of a certain color is close to another pixel of another color, does it mean something in terms of the reflectance of one of the two pixels? Right. So this is what we are trying to look into. Anyway, that's preliminary work with that student using principal component analysis of a very large database of reflectances and trying to infer reflectance from RGB. We also tried to see if we could use BRDF measurements, so RGB image from different angles, so same as the meat thing I was telling you about, to infer the information, the reflectance of a canopy, because otherwise there's really not much BRDF going on for crops. If you have a canopy, you can imagine, depending on the amount of leaves, for example, you would have different BRDF or different RGB measurements from different angles. And it turns out it's subtle, but it's possible to detect, to infer chlorophyll content of some crops based on two multispectral measurements, but difficult with RGB. So we did, like I said, we started with a spectral and we saw, okay, now we have all these wavelengths. Can we find one or two wavelengths, or can we model an RGB sensor based on this and find out if it would work with RGB? It turns out it works barely with multispectral. It really doesn't work with RGB. But we tried, you know. So, and one of the biggest problems, of course, with hyperspectral is that remote sensing, right? Let's talk about remote sensing. That if you put a sensor on the plane and you fly over a farm and you're trying to detect something really special, like nutrient content, like how much nitrogen is in every pixel, you can't do this without having someone go on the field, take a spectrophotometer, and or take a sample, send it to the lab, analyze how much nitrogen is in the sample, map the coordinates at which the sample was taken with the pixel in the image, and do that for several points, several locations on the farm, and then use that as the ground truth, what's called ground truth, basically annotated data. If you think in machine learning terms, you have your training data, that's where you have input and corresponding output. But the corresponding output is often very expensive to get, even if you're just thinking about image labeling or image segmentation. You need people sitting down and drawing boxes around whatever it is that you're trying to segment. It's really time-consuming, and in case of hyperspectral imaging, it's the same motivation. We need some input with matching output labels to be able to then create a model, calibrate, train, and validate a model over a large area. And that's really expensive because you need someone, trained personnel, to go on field. It takes time, especially if it's a big farm, a big place. It's not just for farms, obviously. This is an example of a farm where you have different types of crops. You can even see you have different types of lettuce with different levels of maturity, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks. And you can differentiate between them with hyperspectral imaging. But in order to create this map here, they actually, they knew what was where, right? They just had the farmer. This is where you have your this kind of crop and so on. But if you, in some cases, you don't really have access to the information, like you can't ask the farmer, okay, how much nitrogen is in this parcel? And so in that case, you have to send someone on the field. And it's a problem because you need, if you're doing spectral measurements on the field with an equipment like this, probably much smaller nowadays, that starts to be a very old picture. But you need to calibrate it right, you need to hold it right, your sensor. And it turns out in some cases, I have seen cases where people have come back from ground truth acquisition campaigns showing data and was completely off. And we found out that's because they were just not maintaining the spectrophotometer at the right angle. So that was one example, but it happens more often than you think. And some of my colleagues from University of Rennes in France, where I did my master's actually, they looked at data sets that are used widely used in the remote sensing community. Hyperspectral data with known ground truth. This one is an example. It's a farm in California, Salinas Valley, I think. And this data set is from mid-1990s, and it's been used and used by the research community to train validate models because it's nice, it's easy, you have the ground truth, it's pretty clear what you're trying to predict, and it's nice to train and validate models. But what my colleagues did is that they evaluated a few of those data sets and found out that there's a lot of pixels that are obviously completely off. Like, we have completely different reflectance to the rest of their supposedly class. So, ground truth data is expensive, even more expensive if you want it to be really reliable. So, in some cases, you just can't rely on it. And another kind of ground truth is knowing how many classes you have in your image. For example, if I gave you this hyperspectral image, and then you process it, segment it. You might want to have a little bit more information if you want to apply the clustering algorithm, like k-means. Have you heard of k-means? Yeah. Well, the k stands for how many classes you have. You need to tune it properly. If you don't tune it properly, you will have a wrong result. So parameter tuning, even if it's just one parameter, even if you have a model based on k-nearest neighbors, for example, we also have one k here, but it's really a critical parameter, so it's hard to tune. So the number of clusters, or if you have something called like something based on density estimation, typically you would apply like a. Do you know what kernel density estimation is? You have a data set, you apply a little Gaussian on each of your points, and then you add all the Gaussian, and at some and where you have a higher density, you will have a higher value. Right? The size of the Gaussian, actually, it doesn't have to be a Gaussian, a kernel, any kind of kernel. Would affect how much you balance between local information and global information. And that is typically a difficult parameter to tune when you want to analyze your data. But estimating the density of a hyperspectral image data set will tell you where you have the most information, you know, like where your classes are. So ground truth is difficult, parameter tuning is difficult. And all this, of course, pertains to analyzing the data, a large data set. And you can simulate the ground truth if you don't have it using numerical analysis, physics models. But which model do you choose? How do you validate that model? How do you make sure it actually works? You still need some ground truth data at some point. how do you deal with the fact that these models typically are really computationally expensive, especially if you do numerical analysis, you have to crunch through a lot of data. And well, it's less and less true, obviously, as computers are becoming more powerful, but still, because hyperspectral images are becoming wider, bigger and bigger, more pixels, more spectral bands, the computers are not really catching up on this, on the needs for computational power. Also challenges is that, well, you have a lot of noise and overlap between the clusters. So here you have just two dimensions, and each color represents the different clusters. But if I remove the color, it would be much more difficult for you to find what's what. It could be different types of crops in two wavelengths. So imagine 400 wavelengths and no colors, and very hard to find out what's what. This is where density is useful. You can see there's a bit more density over there. So these are where the centers of your clusters are. Size of a cluster, shape, sparsity can all be very exotic in hyperspectral data. And these are simulated data just to train some models. But this is real hyperspectral data projected on two first principle components. So just reduce the dimensionality in a relatively coarse way. And you can see there's so much overlap between all the different classes, which are different types of minerals, actually, in that case. Minerals and crops, plants. So lots of overlaps, a big problem. And all this happens in very high dimensional space. So if you have two clusters in one dimension, this is of course just an illustration, but just to make a point, high dimensional spaces are difficult to explore. It's something called the curse of dimensionality. If you have two obvious clusters here, they become much less obvious in two dimensions, even less in three, and imagine in 400. So the problem here is that in 400 dimensions, basically every point will start, will become almost equidistant to each other, no matter what their characteristics. And that's what this expression represents. As the dimensionality approaches infinity, the expectation of the contrast between the min and max distances normalized by the mean distance approaches zero. So there's less and less difference between, you take any 2 points in a say 1 million dimensional space, take any 2 points, doesn't matter how they were created, what they represent, they will typically, any three points, they will be equidistant. Right. So there's it's very difficult to identify patterns under these conditions. So even in 400 dimensions, even in 10 dimensions, you start seeing this kind of effect. So you need more and more data as you have more dimensions. I won't go too much into detail. Just very quickly on what we can do to solve this problem of dimensionality. Instead of using the distance between points, we can use so-called secondary measures of distance. So you can look at how many, for given 2 points, how many neighbors they have in common. So in order to find out they are neighbors, you first need to use an Euclidean distance or some kind of distance. But then once you have done this, you use some kind of density attribute to estimate how many points they have in common. And the more points they have in common in their neighborhoods, then the closer these points are. And this works well in high dimensionality. Of course, it's computationally intensive. That's what the shared nearest neighbor graph would give you, for example. You can use something called the minimax distance. So this is something I've worked on quite a lot. It's also based on a graph, and it works well when your clusters are not Gaussian. So you have two crescent-shaped clusters here. Pick 1 point on one cluster. Measure the Euclidean distance to every other point. This is in two dimensions, but imagine 400. And you will, if you do a classification based only on this, then you will find that points that belong to the other cluster are actually much closer, and therefore they're probably more likely to be in the same class, whereas points at the end of the same crescent-shaped cluster are too far to be considered of the same class. So Euclidean distance doesn't work. But if you use the minimax distance, basically it tells you if you have to draw a path between every point, if you take two points, take this star point and the end of the same cluster, the other end of the same cluster, you will draw a path going through every point, not every point, but shortest path going through different points between these two points. And the largest gap you have to cross at any point, this is your minimax distance. So you can see here we will have some pretty narrow steps to do, many of them, but each of them pretty small. Whereas if we want to go to the other cluster, which is really close to it, but it is actually another cluster, you need to make a pretty big step. No matter where you are in this cluster, you need to make a pretty big step to take to the other one. So if you use the minimax distance, you have a much more power to identify your clusters and your classes, especially in high-dimensional spaces. And I think I will stop here because the rest is a bit too, and I've talked too much. But some example of hyperspectral data, typically used in the literature. This was my campus in New Zealand, Massey University. 340 bands. And conclusion. So hyperspectral imaging, really useful in many applications, even if you just focus on agriculture, post-harvest, food science, many applications, and they will be even more in the years to come. But processing that data is very challenging, not only for remote sensing, as I explained, but typically you have a lot of data. You have something called the curse of dimensionality, too many dimensions, really high to figure out what's going on when you have 400 dimensions. A lot of noise, variations in cluster shapes and size, cluster imbalance, some clusters are smaller than others. The ground truth can help, but it often has a significant cost, and that is true for, like I said, any sort of machine learning or statistical learning model where you need some ground truth, some annotations, some labeled data. And one way to solve this issue is to analyze density of your data, figure out where you have the highest density. In order to measure this, you can, of course, use different types of measures of distance, because density will be based on distance. But density means information. That's pretty much the way around ground truth for hyperspectral image analysis. Find density, find a good way to measure density, and you can already process your data. So typically, if you don't have ground truth, you would use unsupervised techniques that would never give you the same accuracy as a fully supervised technique, but it will help pre-process the data, present it to an operator who will then spend less time on it because it would have been already pre-processed. All right, anyway, any questions on this? I've been a little quick on the last part. I apologize for this, but I guess the first part was the most relevant to show you how it's applied. Yes, it can be very accurate. I guess it depends on the product. I haven't really worked on specifically that kind of applications. A little bit on kiwi fruits, but from what I can tell, it was very accurate.
So, theoretically, it's possible to capture a picture and then, based on the picture, find out how many calories in the food, for example?
I guess so. I'm not sure if calorie is only a result of sugar, but. I suppose so, yeah.
You also showed the identification of fats and proteins.
Yes. So you can imagine maybe in the future you will have a hyperspectral sensor on your phone, you take a picture of the restaurant and, that's too many calories, guys. Well, hopefully in our lifetime, but it will probably take longer than that. Any other questions? Well, then I will see you tomorrow for a different topic.